Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, September 15th. With me now is Maria Hinojosa. Many of you know her from her work on the public radio show Latino USA, or from her Emmy Award-winning work on television, or her appearances elsewhere as a political analyst. And we will talk some politics in this segment, as usual when Maria comes on, today including why Donald Trump, whose original campaign centerpiece was the lie that Mexican immigrants are dangerous to others, is hoping for a rising share of the Latinx vote this year and seeing it in some recent polls. He held the Latinos for Trump event in Arizona yesterday because apparently he sees hope there. And how is Joe Biden competing for votes in the many diverse Latinx communities? But today we will also talk about American politics in the context of Maria Hinojosa's life, because she has a new memoir just published called Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. Maria, big congrats on the book. I don't know how you found the time with all you do, but it's wonderful, and thanks for coming on to share.
Brian, I could not be more thrilled to be launching the book at WNYC with you. So it's just really, really a pleasure to be on with all my fellow New Yorkers. And you know how I did it, Brian? I at one point I just told my team I'm not going to the office anymore. And I would sit down and write every morning, including Saturdays and Sundays, until I couldn't. And that's how I, you know, I basically was in quarantine, So I was kind of setting up for this experience. Mm. And thankfully, here we are, publication day. Woo-woo!
Woo-woo. And you've already busted one big stereotype with this book, that radio people can't write full sentences. So thank you on behalf of all of us.
You know, I do think it's interesting that the whole issue of the writing, I talk a lot about imposter syndrome in this book. It's something that so far a lot of people have been intrigued by, because it's like, wow, we don't really hear about kind of people who have made it talking a lot about imposter syndrome. And so I deal with it. I dealt with it in the writing of this book. You know, I think it's okay to be a little bit insecure, because if you don't have any level of humility or insecurity, you turn out to be somebody who, I don't know, I think we can all think of who that person might be right now, who is, you know, leading our country in a very dangerous way. And then actually, I think he's very insecure. I think that's the whole issue. So dealing with imposter syndrome, dealing with our insecurities, and pushing through is part of the message.
And the title, Once I Was You, we first encounter the phrase at the end of the introduction to the book. You're writing about a child, a girl at the McAllen Airport in Texas, and you write, I see you because once I was you. Would you start by telling us about that little girl who you said you once were?
Well, me or the little girl I saw? Me, what ends up happening, Brian, is that in the writing of this book, it's kind of coinciding with everything that has been the culmination of not just 4 years or 3 years of anti-immigrant behavior by this country that has crystallized under Donald Trump. I mean, the book is saying this has been centuries in the making. But that the little girl that I was actually unaware that I had almost been taken by immigration agents. When I was a little girl at that age, like the little girl who I see in the McAllen Airport, probably 10 years old, I was busy trying to be a good American girl. I was very proud of being Mexican in Chicago, but I knew feeling invisible, but I certainly didn't feel the kind of hatred that the little girl at the airport who I encounter in the McAllen Airport, who ultimately, as you know, I use very harsh words. I say, this is a child that is being trafficked, that is being transported, that is being kidnapped by the government.
She had confirmed to you that she was being housed in a detention camp, and this was in the family separation period, or at least when it was much in the news. And you describe her situation as one of the modern horrors of the USA.
So if, you know, right now we're not traveling in airports. I haven't been to an airport since March, but when we were in airports, if you looked around, you could see this. You could see children who were all wearing sweatsuits, ill-fitting, cheap sweatsuits. And you would look at these kids and you'd be like, who are they? Like, why are they all together? Like, are they a school trip? Are they a soccer team? No, they're not. They're not happy. Mm. What's going on here? So all I'm saying is that children being trafficked exists right here in New York City. There are places where these children have been brought to right here in New York City. And that notion of once I was you is I'm really trying to push ourselves to understand that these children could be our children, and that children are being taken from their parents and moved around. Imagine. And so it is on all of us to be responsible to deconstruct this. I hope that my book, you know, yes, it's my story, but it's the larger context of how did this happen and the history of it. And I hope that it means people understand that they each – all of us have a responsibility in this.
Yes, and one of the reasons that I asked you about that little girl's story so early on is that because one of the beautiful things about your book is that while telling your own story, you also center the stories of other immigrants who might not have the privilege that you have at this point of telling their stories in public. And one of the ways that you connect yourself to the girl at McAllen Airport is because once you were a girl at the airport, a baby, in fact, who was coming in with your family who had green cards, but then they told your mother they would separate you from her. Will you share that story?
Oh, it's just even hearing you say it, I'm like, oh my God, because I had to ask the story of like, so mom, you know, how did we get to Chicago? From Mexico. My dad was hired by the University of Chicago. He's a medical doctor dedicated to research and helped to create the cochlear implant. So we all get on a plane and we fly from Mexico City to Dallas and change planes in Dallas to go to Chicago. And, you know, the way my mom kind of told this story was that this very tall Texan immigration agent had said, you know, that I looked a little sick and maybe they needed to keep me, and that my mom kind of stood up to him and said, sir, you know, my husband is Dr. Raul Hinojosa, and basically created a scene in the airport. And so the story had always been like, oh my God, my mom is such a badass. Now I know why I'm tiny but mighty. You know, mm-hmm. She's such a feminist. She owned her voice. And then at the height of this horror that we were hearing, the voices of these children crying, my mother calls me. I'm at an airport in transit, and she says, mamita, and she's in tears. She's heaving, and she says, that was me. That was you. It could have been us. And I was like, what are you talking about, mom? Mom, what are you talking about? And she says, mijita, they tried to take you from me. Do you understand? And I was like, oh, my God. And she said, and I had to scream at that agent. And she said, those mothers right now who have lost their children, that could have been me. And that, Brian, was the moment when everything just changed in my life.
You only learned that story recently?
The story of coming and kind of like, oh, he wanted to take you because you had a rash. But it was like, we didn't focus on the taking part. We focused on the fact that my mom stood up to the guy, right?
Got it.
And for me, I was always like, oh my God, that must have been some weird solo immigration agent that was like some weird dude, you know, like, where were they going to put me? And well, it turns out, Brian, that they were taking children at that time. That was what was happening. There was, I haven't found it yet, I have to go back, but there was more than likely a room in the Dallas airport in the early 1960s where they were putting children, babies. So where did they end up? Where were they? And that, I think, is the horror, is that, you know, I used to think, oh my God, it was just a fluke. It just happened to me. And then you're like, holy gosh, it could have been me. It absolutely could have been me, but for having a mother who, you know, chose to speak out and own her voice and own her privilege, frankly.
And you describe your mom early in the book as just before moving to the U.S. from Mexico, having the mixed emotions of ecstasy and shame. And that was really evocative. Can you describe both things a little bit and how common you think it might be in other immigrants?
Oh, my gosh. Everybody who's listening to this right now knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because, you know, my father, for example, who became an American citizen, the first out of the family. So when we would go back to Mexico every year from Chicago by car, no, a mi papá lo insultaban. They insulted my dad. Eres un vendido. You're a sellout. Eres un pocho. You're an American. Eres un gabacho. You're a gringo. I mean, it was all joking, but no. They were shaming my father because he had chosen to follow his mission of being, you know, of helping people to hear, those who were deaf and wanted to. And they shamed him for moving to the United States. They were also secretly very proud of him and jealous. You know, but on the other hand, my mom was like, wow, you know, she was much younger. And she was like, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. I mean, I'm going to get to experience like this incredible country and I'm going to learn all these things and I'm going to have an amazing experience. And so that was, and I think that that kind of, for all immigrants, we experience that. What I try to resolve in the book is to say that notion of no soy de aquí ni de allá, I'm neither from there nor from here, is actually our superpower. That is our superpower. And if we are living in this country with or without papers, with or without citizenship, these are our American stories. And we have to own them and tell them. They're not Latino stories or immigrant. They're American stories, 100%.
My guest telling her American stories, if you don't already recognize the voice, is Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA on public radio, among other things. And her new memoir out today is Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. And we'll get to some politics of the day, but the story of your life, of course, cannot be reduced to an immigrant story. Your intersectionalism, as you've described many aspects of your life, is also a woman's story, a sexual assault survivor's story, a journalist's story, to be sure, a wife and mother's story. And if people think of you as telling primarily an immigrant story, what other part of your life do you either like talking about a lot publicly or feel it's more important to, given the context of this book?
So I love all of that. You know, it is a book, it's like a feminist book because I'm growing up in the 60s and 70s. I am a rape survivor. I didn't even realize that until much later in my life. It all kind of came tumbling out with the Christine Blasey Ford testimony and Brett Kavanaugh and his resistance to accept what had happened. You know, the lingering trauma of that. It is my longtime relationship with an African-American woman who is my mentor and, you know, my first understanding of civil rights coming from seeing Dr. Martin Luther King speak. And so, you know, growing up on the South Side of Chicago, living in Harlem now, which is where my company is based, you know, I mean, my gosh, I haven't left Harlem since March. This is my community, my neighborhood. I love talking about the journalism side of it. I get into a lot of the ethics of the kind of journalism issues that we face, having been the first Latina in all of the newsrooms where I worked, which many other journalists of color are just like, what? You were the first? And I'm like, yeah. I mean, I was the first at WNYC. My gosh, I remember going up to the old building there in the municipal building. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was my job. So I loved clearly saying, I know you want to box us in, and I know, yes, there is the immigrant story, and I deal with immigration policy and history, but please understand that we as immigrants in this country are that. We are Americans. And so talk to us about pop culture. Talk to us about, you know, religion. Talk to us about anything that has to do with your life, because that's the same things that are happening with our lives. So I think, you know, for me, talking about being a survivor of rape, I think, you know, most people may not expect me to be talking about that. And also talking about the journalism side and kind of writing for Walter Cronkite and meeting him and doing those things, anything that helps to move it beyond. And I don't say just an immigrant story, but to understand the complexity of our immigrant stories.
To bring us to the presidential race of today, Let me ask you to take us through a little bit of the political history that you do in the book alongside your personal story. How do you see the Republican Party over the course of your lifetime, and how do you see the Democrats? And on the Republican side, I know we don't have 53 hours, but on the Republican side, a lot of people these days cite Ronald Reagan as believing in America as an open borders country, at least in theory. Here's a very famous clip that gets cited as a contrast to Trump.
I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
So that was from his farewell address. And if you think that was a one-off, listeners, he came back and back to that kind of theory. Here's one other Reagan clip from another time.
Rather than making them or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways.
Talking about Mexican people and the Mexican border, obviously. And then George W. Bush seemed popular with Mexican-American voters in Texas and tried for comprehensive immigration reform as president, path to citizenship for a better sealing of the border. That was supposed to be the trade-off, if that's a fair reduction of it. So how do you see that arc or that internal Republican tension that led us to Trump?
Yeah, I think this was really a difficult thing for me, was to kind of realize how both the Republicans and the Democrats have essentially thrown immigrants under the bus time and time again. So, you know, Ronald Reagan did create the Immigration Reform and Control Act in 1986, and that did end up legalizing about 3 million undocumented people. I know people whose children were named after Nancy and Ronald Reagan. Their Mexican children were named that because they were thankful to Ronald Reagan, though they did not necessarily turn into Republican voting Latinos and Latinas. So on the one hand, Reagan was doing that, but if you remember back to the 1980s, he was also bombing Central America. He was sending military aid. Oliver North was corrupting, the support for the contra-revolutionaries who were, you know, against the Sandinista government, which was supported by the people. So that's the perfect example, is that on the one hand, Ronald Reagan was saying, wow, immigrants, let them come. By the way, interesting clip. Let them come and work here. Let them come and get their work thing going on. So it is understanding the economic benefit of immigrants. He did understand that. On the other hand, he was, you know, destabilizing Central America in the 1980s. So it's no surprise that Central American refugee children, mothers, men are still coming here to the United States now. So, you know, is it a pretty thing to have to say that Bill Clinton signed the most destructive anti-immigrant laws in 1996.
Which
signed
one?
Them in, so, for example,
for
this
people
was
people who don't know that history.
So this is basically Bill Clinton who ran on an anti-immigrant platform. It was Bill Clinton who was saying, we need to take care of that border and those illegals coming over here. He had an ad, a famous ad. And he was doing all of these Operation Bootstrap, going down on the border and just, you know, again, kind of militarizing the border, in my view, unnecessarily, and signing into laws, for example, this notion that there are aggravated felonies. Look, there's a felony and it's a felony. What is this aggravated felony? Well, now an immigrant, and only an immigrant, can be charged with an aggravated felony, which therefore means he is deportable. Prior to that, the felony, you know, if you had a green card, for example, like I know many people, ended up serving a year or two for selling drugs on the streets and then changed their lives around. No, now you could be deported for that offense. So it's like double jeopardy. He was signing into law all of these insidious little changes that would lead to where we are now. And he was doing it at a time in 1996 when there really was an anti-immigrant fervor. And that's what's so sad about it, because it was like, yo, Bill Clinton, like, you were doing this at a time when people really were not even on an anti-immigrant tip here. And that wasn't the vibe. And so the reckoning, you know, as I hear Ronald Reagan, I'm thinking about, wow, Republicans, what are you going to do in the future? Because, you know, you could have had a future if Ronald Reagan's, you know, he was like, Latinos are Republicans, they just don't know it yet. You could have had a future. What's going to happen to the Republican Party post-Trump? And the Democrats, as we know, Brian, we're watching this in real time. It's like they're missing the dance. It's like, hello, Latino voters are going to put you over the top in that way that you want it to be, massive, and you're still coming late to the dance.
How?
Well, I mean, how could it be that during the Democratic National Convention that any Latino or Latina on social media was posting the question of, why are we invisible from the Democratic National Convention? Why is AOC only getting 1 minute? I don't care what the politics are behind it. I get party politics. But you now created a dynamic where Latino voters are saying, why were we invisible? That should never have been a question coming out of the Democratic National Convention, ever. And so the fact that it is their failure. And I'll say it again. I'm going to say it right now, because the fact that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have not sat down with me when I sat down with every other candidate who gave me an hour, Brian. What's that about? Yes, Latinos and Latinas are engaged, but we want answers and we want accountability. And it's a mistake to just think that we are going to fall into line because the Democratic Party has some reckoning to do with these voters. Having said that, I think many of them, you know, will not vote for Donald Trump because they are bearing the brunt of this horror. But there are Latinos and Latinas in Florida, in Texas, here in New York, who will vote for Donald Trump. It should not be surprising to people. You know, when you are told to hate yourself, when a candidate begins his campaign by insulting who you are, I'm a Mexican, a lot of people are like, geez, I don't want to be that. I'll be anything but that. So we have to understand self-hatred. It's an ugly thing.
Maria Hinojosa, her brand new book is called Once I Was You, A Memoir of Love and Hate in a Torn America. If you want to hear and see more of Maria Hinojosa, she's going to be hosting a virtual event in conjunction with the book release tonight at 7 o'clock, technically from the Hudson Library in Hudson, Ohio, but I think you're in Harlem today, right? It
yes.
is part of an ongoing virtual book tour with the full calendar available on her Twitter feed, which is at Maria_Hinojosa. And here is to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris doing an interview for Latino USA. If you're out there, Joe and Kamala, before you do this show, I know this is a local New York show in a blue state, do Maria Hinojosa's show. So there you
Brian,
go.
Brian, you know what? Hold on a second. I just want to say that is what allyship looks like. As a journalist, that is what allyship looks like. So thank you, Brian, because we are very competitive in our field. And so for you to say, do Latino USA first, you know, I'm just, Brian, that's why people love you, because you are a good ally and you move with the heart and you're also a brilliant journalist. And so thank you so much for this beautiful interview. I really appreciate it.
I'm genuinely touched coming from you, and I'm blushing right now. And Maria, thanks a lot. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, dear.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.